This episode was recorded as part of Willy Lit Fest. Willy Lit Fest is on in Williamstown in Melbourne in June of each year. It is an incredible festival. It's got such a relaxed and fun vibe, and the programming is top notch. This year, for example, they had a swimming salon. So four riders did readings, and then everyone, riders and audience members, went for a swim afterwards in the very, very cold ocean. I am 1000% attending that session next year. The session you're about to hear is me, Catherine, interviewing Pip Finkmeyer about her debut book entitled Sad Girl Novel. Enjoy.
Today, we are gathered on the unceded lands of the Bunurong people of the Kulin Nation. I ran up the stairs. Today, we are gathered on the unceded lands of the Bunurong people, and I would like to pay my respects to elders past and present, especially as we, at a festival like this that engages in words and storytelling, it's really important to acknowledge that storytelling has existed on this stolen land for 60,000 plus years, and we are just a blip in that story. But what an honour to be a blip. Today, I'm going to pass you over to Catherine Collette. Catherine is the host of the First Time podcast, and she is a novelist of two books. Her latest one, The Competition, came out last year with Text Publishing. It is hilarious, and I don't say that very lightly. It's hard to make a funny book, and Catherine did a good job on her sophomore novel. Thank you, everyone, for being here, and I hope to see you somewhere else at the festival over the course of the weekend. Thank you.
Thanks, Emily. I am very excited to be here today, and I would like to introduce my special guest that I'll be talking to. This is Pip Finkmeyer. Pip Finkmeyer's fiction has been listed for the Desperate Literature Short Fiction Prize, the Rochelle Prize for Emerging Writers, the Disquiet Literary Prize, and nominated for a Pushcart Prize. She co-founded the Berlin-based Nothing to See Here zine, and completed a master's in publishing and editing at RMIT. She lives in Naarm, Melbourne, and Sad Girl Novel is her first book. Welcome, Pip, and welcome to everybody in the room.
Thank you.
Just, Emily's already sort of touched on this, but just a flag for those that are in the audience today, we'll have time for questions towards the end. If you don't have questions, that's okay, I have heaps. If you have comments, that's okay too. Controversial opinion, I don't mind a long-winded comment. I'm all right with it. We're here today talking about Sad Girl Novel. If you have not read this book, you absolutely must. I think it is one of the best books I've read this year. I said in an Instagram post yesterday that I feel like it should come with all the sentences underlined or highlighted to save you the trouble of doing it yourself. There are so many Easter eggs in these sentences. It is the kind of thing that, as a writer, you just want to steal every little bit and try and pass it off on your own. So congratulations, Pip.
Thank you. That's so nice.
So we're going to talk about the book. We're also going to talk a little bit about Sad Girl novels in general. But we'll start with writing. Pip, has writing always been a part of your life?
I think that when I was growing up, I didn't know I was allowed to be a novelist. I didn't know that real people did that. So I wasn't aiming for it until maybe I moved overseas and started hanging out with other people that wrote novels. But I always kept a diary, and I didn't really know what I was doing. But then when I moved home back from overseas and unpacked all my belongings and looked at the diaries, I realized I was always writing. I just didn't know what I was doing. And the diaries are terrible, but I was trying. And then I was circling around writing. So I was working in bookstores, and then I studied book publishing, and then I worked briefly in publishing. So I was circling around it, but it wasn't until I moved overseas that I kind of started writing in earnest and started trying to publish short stories and things like that.
I love that. I also like, I love zines. I always think that zines are a little bit like PhDs in that they're such a, they're almost like a character tell in some ways. They're so specific in what a person writes about. What were your zines about?
That's very, yeah, this probably reveals a lot about me, maybe. Me and my friends, we had this little writing group. There was probably about six of us, and every month we would have to come with a story. And you were given the title of the story and then some prompt words. And then, so it was actually, we were trying to do like an erotica comedy type thing. Sort of inspired by the podcast, my dad wrote a porno, that sort of erotica. But it's really hard to write erotica. So we were writing short stories that were like sort of getting somewhere, but nothing would ever happen in them. And then, so there was like a really fun sort of like dorky thing that we were doing. And then we started to think that we had guests come into the group, and when we realized that the, what we were writing was actually kind of interesting. So we published our favorite stories in a zine and got our friends to illustrate it. And it was really fun. It kind of like made a little community around it.
I love that. Okay, so going from diary writing and zines, flash forward a few years to Willy Litfest. We're now talking about your debut book, Sad Girl Novel. Give us the elevator pitch. What is it about?
Well, plot-wise, I think it's about... Kim is a young Australian woman living in Berlin, and she's given herself the goal of writing a novel in 1 year. She's never written anything before, and it's entirely possible that she's completely deluded in her quest. But she could also be a creative genius, and you just never can tell. And then her best friend is called Belle, and she's a German historian, and at the same time as Kim's writing her book, Belle's having a baby by herself. So there's sort of, the story sort of focuses on their twin acts of creation and the way that friendship, like the way friends blindly support each other, can sometimes cross over into like a mutual delusion.
I think you were going to do a reading.
Oh yeah, I certainly am. I'm going to read from chapter one, so it doesn't really need a setup. It's set in 2019 in Berlin. Okay. I think it was the third time I got attacked by a stranger on a train that I thought, maybe it's time to leave Berlin for a while. There was a man throwing candy at people and then asking them for money. His strategy was to throw the candy fast, so it went in a straight line instead of a curved one. Most people would lift and squeeze their hands in front of their face as a reflex. When they looked down to see what they had caught, the man would smile and ask them to pay for it, in the tone of any man behind a counter making a regular transaction. The reason this qualified as an attack in my book, or even as a personal attack, was that I didn't have the reflexes everyone else did. The confectionery hit me in the forehead and made the sound of a knuckle popping. I only left my Keats once a week, and this was one of the reasons why. Awkward interactions with strangers on trains. The other reason I never left my neighborhood was because I had nowhere to go. All I had was a project that required me to sit alone in my apartment day and night, drinking stovetop espresso from a black Bialetti. I would be lying if I said I didn't enjoy the simplicity of only caring about one thing. I let the rest of my life fall away in pieces, like a cliff face collapsing into the sea. I felt like a monk making great sacrifices for divinity. My goal was to write a book in 1 year and try to not make it about me. But so far, it kind of was. Writing about yourself doesn't feel like the most divine thing ever. There's supposed to be something other involved, some faith in unseen forces. I read somewhere that writing is like a way of connecting with higher power, what some people would describe as a dialogue with God. Therapists were good for that too. So I caught the train once a week to see Debbie. Her office was on the other side of the ring, in Prenzlauer Berg, a suburb with an inexplicable amount of earthy toy shops and pregnancy yoga. The ring was made by the Ringbahn, the train line that ran in a circle all around the inner city suburbs, like clockwork, if you imagine clocks that also went backwards at the same time as going forwards, because it ran both clockwise and anti-clockwise at all times. It was far, but I was lucky to find a therapist at all, so I went. The train ride was the perfect amount of time for me to run through a bullet point list of neuroses in my head like a military drill. It was when I prepared all my best material. Ask Debbie about Matthew. Ask Debbie about Matthew's invitation. Ask Debbie if your novel is stupid. Ask Debbie if your life is stupid. Ask Debbie if it's wrong to be jealous of your best friend's newborn baby. Don't ask Debbie, but try to ascertain, does Debbie like you?
It's so good. Okay, there's a lot in that we're going to pick out and talk to today, but I have to start with this idea of sad girl novels. It's obviously the title of the book. In the book, Kim is writing a sad girl novel. She's also kind of in a sad girl novel. Sad girl novels are a thing. What do you see as the characteristics of a sad girl novel?
That's a good question. I think in 2019, sad girl novels were still like becoming a thing. And maybe on one side you have the Sally Rooney type of sad girl where she's like... most of the female protagonists of sad girl novels, they are laying around all day. And that is why people are resentful of them and see them as privileged, which they are. There's this element of privilege. And I think part of the reason we enjoy reading about them is because we wish we could also lay around all day. And I think my year of rest and relaxation is probably the best example of that. So Tessa Moshfegh, I think she's one of the big early ones, and she's someone that I definitely like reading. But yeah, it's written by a young woman. It's about a young woman. She's having an existential crisis or slowly unraveling. And she's also got a depressing job, usually. And a bad therapist, maybe. Yeah.
A bad therapist is great. In an interview in The Guardian, you said you felt conflicted about the genre because it can sometimes be mean-spirited. What aspect do you think has the potential to be mean-spirited?
I think that making fun of people is really easy, and it doesn't take a lot of talent, perhaps, to just write something that's a straight-up satire, or you need to put a little bit of... the story needs to have its own heart and soul and needs to be trying to do something. It can't just be making fun of things. I think... I'm thinking of a particular author, but I don't want to name them, but they're very successful, and they've... Yeah, there's some books set in Berlin where it's just making fun of all the cliches of the type of person that moves to Berlin, which are all completely accurate. But it needs to be like trying to say something and treating people with kindness. I'm making fun of myself more than anyone else in the book. Yeah.
Is there a moment as you were writing that you realised what you were writing could be seen as a sad girl novel?
Not really. I mean, towards the end, there's a big argument between two of the main characters, and the other one tells Kim she's writing a sad bitch novel. And so obviously I knew at some point that I was too. But the name is referring to the book within the book, but the reception of the book so far has let me know that I actually was writing a sad girl novel, so that's fine.
Surprise.
Yeah.
I think what's so interesting about the book is that there is this... it is kind of a sad girl novel, but it feels like it's aware of that fact, like that it's aware of the criticism of sad girl novels. One way that it does that is that Kim, the main character, is very aware of her own privilege. And so she says, I wanted so desperately not to feel so affected by small things, but the spectrum of my life experience was so narrow, I only had small things to be shaped by. Poor me. It's very easy to dismiss a sad, privileged girl and say, nothing's wrong, life is good, you should be happy. Kim is clearly not happy. Do you think that sadness in the face of struggles that seem to be quite small, is that something that's related to privilege, or is it more universal?
That's a very good question. I think that, sadness is not a competition, and that expressing your dissatisfaction with the world is not really taking anything away from anyone else's struggles. But obviously when I was writing this book, you know, the pandemic was happening, so it was hard to feel like at the end of it that this story would be important at times. So yeah, I definitely have struggled with like thinking that but all the books that I like reading they're all like these small personal stories with a really small set of characters, but you can extrapolate a lot from them, and I think that's what fiction's really good for. Everything could be seen as like an allegory for a broader social thing. And then I was sort of thinking most books hinge on some sort of suffering that's like current, gives it currency or newsworthy. It makes it newsworthy. And my book doesn't really have that. It's just like, Kim's always saying like, my pain is worse than everyone else's, which is obviously not true. So I'm sort of making fun of her. But what I was sort of drawn to was the universality of that feeling of among a certain milieu, if I can say that word. Like, and that, yeah, it's a story that a lot of people can relate to, I think. Yeah,
I agree. Okay, so Kim is in her 20s. She's an Australian living in Berlin. You've obviously also lived in Berlin. If you had to describe Berlin in three words, how would you describe it?
Fun, grim, horny. Maybe.
Didn't go to Berlin. Do you think Kim would describe it the same way?
I think Kim would say unfair, because she's kind of a little bit entitled. So I guess I had a lot of friends that moved to Berlin and then seemed to like complain that it was really hard to live there. And because it's a place that's over, you know, there's just not a lot of, it's not an abundant place like Australia when it comes to jobs and things like that. So I think Kim would say unfair, and then I think she would say cool and lonely, maybe. Yeah.
Well, that was my next question, was how does being so far from home impact her relationships?
I think because in the beginning I actually didn't know whether she had to be Australian or not, because I wanted her to be sort of like the every woman of a sad girl novel and sort of the every woman of an Auslander, which is like a foreigner. So I was thinking to make her more like generic, I could make her like American or British, because that's what Berlin is full of. But then I wanted to make her Australian mainly because I think the humour, it's unavoidable that she's going to be Australian because it's my humour. But also because she's so far from home, it's just a really good way to... Like, I enjoy novels where they don't give the person a lot of backstory and they don't really have any ties. It's like you start with where they are on the first page and you go forward and you never really look back. So that made it easier with the plot to not bring her family background into it, so she could sort of be more anonymous that way. And then it also helped with the friendship with Kim and Belle, because they're both far from home. They're like fused into this little mini family as well, because Belle has this baby by herself, so Kim is supposed to be standing in as like the other parent, but often fails to do so. Yeah.
Their relationship is really interesting. It's it feels like a very honest depiction of female friendship. Like, there is this love and earnestness and support on the one hand, but on the other, there's something that's not those things. To me, it almost feels like there's a game element to it, or how would you describe this sort of perhaps darker side of their friendship?
I think that they do love each other, and that's sort of unwavering, but there's jealousy there and pettiness, and they've both taken divergent paths. So I think the leading up to turning 30, Kim's 27, Belle's about 34. So they're like either side of equidistant from 30, if you want to say that. Like, whether you like it or not, there's always choices to make about babies. If you're a woman, even if you have no interest, or you, 30 is sort of like when you start to think about these things. So it's when you start making choices that lead you down one road or another, and then you may sort of feel differently towards your friends that took different paths. So there's a little bit of... there's this interesting comparison there. And then also I was thinking about with female friendship how I don't want to say it's very popular now because it's always been, but it's popular to explore in books. And this idea of blindly supporting each other, which is what a lot of women are amazing at doing. But sometimes it's like you have to tell your friend that they're being delusional. And if you don't, then it can have bad consequences. And so, yeah, it's like exploring the darkness of friendship. And I think there's something really nice about having a friend that you love so much that you can be really petty and jealous around them and not try and hide it. Yeah.
Pettiness is so interesting to read about, yeah. I reckon. It's such a great, an underrated aspect of a relationship. One of the other main relationships in the book is between Kim and Matthew. Matthew is a literary agent from New York. I feel like there's something about romantic love, and particularly that early stage of romantic love, that is always a bit imagined and in your head, the way you play out the future with a person. What role do you think Matthew plays, both real and imagined, in Kim's life?
Yeah, that's definitely true. So I open the book with Kim being obsessed with a man called Matthew. And that is definitely a comment on what happens in a lot of side girl novels. It's about a woman being obsessed with like an unavailable man, like maybe The Idiot and Either Or by Elif Betterman and a bunch of other ones. And I just wanted to purposefully sort of turn that trope around. So, yeah, lean into like the time in your life when you move overseas, usually you think you're going to meet somebody that's going to open up a new world to you. And I think that we're socialized to think that's going to be a romantic connection, and maybe you don't have your eyes open to the fact that it's a platonic one. And so the whole book's about how platonic love is like often pushed to the side in favor of romance, especially in books. It's strange how few books feature a friendship as the primary relationship. And then, yeah, Kim meets this man called Matthew. I think it's entirely unclear how much she is imagined versus how much is real, because she is sort of becoming more and more like disconnected from reality. And Matthew's a literary agent. He convinces her she has talent. And then it's sort of like that little kernel of external motivation is enough to drive her forward. And then the book sort of plays around with the idea that, you know, that external motivation that you get, it can be completely fake, but it's still effective.
It's very effective for her. In the reading that you did, you mentioned Kim's therapist, Debbie. Kim recognises Debbie might not be the best therapist. As a storytelling choice, why is an average therapist better than a good one?
Great question. I think that... Well, therapy is great because you can, in a book and in real life, but you can see the character, you can see the way that they filter their thoughts when you switch from an inner monologue to dialogue in a space where they're supposed to not be filtering them, like for social niceties and stuff. So it's a really good way to show what's going on inside a person's brain. And then having a bad therapist is honestly just drawn from real life, with every person I know in Berlin being in therapy. And it's actually free to go to therapy in Germany. It's covered by health insurance, yeah. But it's really, really hard to find a therapist, especially one that speaks English. So I had a lot of friends who were just persisting with their obviously terrible therapists because it was free and you couldn't get another one. So Debbie's like pretty good compared to some what happened in reality. But I think Debbie, because we, just in general, I don't really want like the characters to be good. And I think writing a character that's beyond reproach is really easy, but really uninteresting. And it's fun to watch someone be terrible, because that's the label fiction allows you to do all that stuff without consequences. Debbie's sort of like a matriarch of the book, and I just love that she's totally inappropriate. But
she's sort of an ironic matriarch, isn't she? We've touched on the fact that Kim is a writer. She doesn't only want to write a book, she wants to write a bestseller. Don't we all? She's working on a novel which she describes as a genre fiction turducken. What's a turducken?
She's writing a... First of all, Kim has questionable taste. So, well, I don't know. Maybe some people think it sounds good, but she's writing a horror inside a romance, inside a third thing, which, and the third genre is Woman Goes Crazy, which is very close to like sad girl novels, I guess. And she's trying to fit three genres together because she's trying to like hit all those like big commercial points, I guess, because Kim is the type of person who would try and reverse engineer a bestseller. So, which, you know, can't be done as far as I'm concerned. But she goes to Frankfurt Book Fair in the opening part and tries to observe what's happening in the industry and then sort of tries to design her book around that, which to me makes her slightly villainous in that moment because I think that's quite an evil thing to do. But she never just sits down and like enjoys writing, the practice of writing. It's always about like the cumulative. She's thinking about the end product and she's thinking about like being a novelist. But genre, yeah, I wanted to play with genre a lot in the book and I couldn't really help it. I originally wanted to do horror part one, romance and erotica part two, and then going crazy part three. But then it sort of fell away, like a lot of things with structure, where you put some ideas in place to get you going and then you realise you don't need that anymore, like the scaffolding. But the whole book is named after a genre. So obviously I'm drawn to genre somehow.
Okay. Maybe we'll continue with writing, the process of writing. It feels like circles are a big theme within this book. The opening that you've read out talks about circles. We have the sense that Kim's spiraling, which is a kind of a circle. What is the significance of circles?
It's very circular. The whole structure of the book is inspired by a train line, which was talked about in the bit I read, called the Ringbahn, which goes around the city in circles endlessly. And so I wanted Kim's journey to sort of replicate that. And the three parts, the catalyst is always like an incident with a stranger on a train, causes her to leave Berlin and then come back. So it's just a series of circles. And I think she's that type of character who's sort of like a friend that you adore, but she's young and she drives you crazy. And she has very like neurotic tendencies. She's just going around in circles and you can't. Like the reader can see so easily what she needs to do, but she can't. She keeps repeating the same things over and over again, which I think is like a hallmark of youth in a way. I've always been attracted to stories that bring you back to where you started, so you feel like the author knew what they were doing the whole time. Yeah.
That idea of circles, and as you say, you come back to where you started. Do you think that Kim evolves throughout the book?
Not as much as she could, but she does. She has a moment of growth. Towards the end, I think she reckons with her privilege a little bit more and she realizes what she needs to do and that, yeah. She grows and she reckons with like her friendship to Belle and how she could have behaved better.
Kim gets some writing advice from a established career novelist and he says that she should get used to rejections. She should send things into the world and expect that people will come back and say no and that she kind of needs to exercise this muscle of rejection. It's a great approach. I see the merit of it. Kim doesn't exactly take that advice. She instead reads other people's rejections online.
Yeah, she's living in this world where she can't... Her idea that she might be a genius can't be dashed because she hasn't tried to do anything yet. And so she doesn't want to write a story and submit it and get rejected because that would maybe confirm or otherwise... Yeah, it's supposed to be completely ambiguous whether she's good or bad, and I think that's something that every like early stage writer goes through before they've gotten published, so I wanted to sort of sit in that a bit more. But then, yeah, there's these, I don't know if anyone's ever submitted to literary journals, but you get these rejection letters, which are really funny. Well, sometimes they're just blanket, but you can Google them. There's this thing called Rejection Wiki, where you can look at other people's rejection letters and compare yours to theirs to see how harshly you were being rejected.
Wow.
Yeah. And so my friend put me onto that. And so sometimes, so you can get a hard rejection, which is just like, no, or you can get a soft rejection where they've personalized it. And that's like, yay. And
yeah.
Yeah. So then,
Is a less rejecty rejection.
It's like, we don't want this, but keep sending us your work.
Yeah.
But then sometimes you go on Rejection Wiki or whatever it's called, and you realize that was just it wasn't personalized.
Right.
It was just a full-on rejection.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That's kind of crushing.
Yeah, I think so. I remember being like clinging to a soft rejection from like Granta or something. So then I just didn't look on Rejection Wiki because I didn't want to know, much like Kim. Yeah.
Good advice. On the topic of rejection, we love talking about rejection and failure on this podcast. Do you have a favourite rejection or failure?
No. There's definitely been... I actually, early on, I stopped taking rejection personally, and I don't think... You know, anyone would want to read a magazine that accepts every single thing that everyone sends to it. So, but once I was invited to do a reading at this like night in Berlin, I was very excited about. It was like very cool, and the theme was blood, and I set the theme because I had written a book about blood. I had written a story about blood, And then I got kind of replaced at the last minute by somebody else who I had invited to the event. And so because I invited her, she found out about it and she submitted her thing and I got bumped from the lineup. So that was a pretty harsh one. But then I went and listened to her thing and it wasn't that good, to be honest. But everybody else was so good that I was like, this is how I deal with rejection is... looking at the thing that beat me out and realizing how good they are, and then you just don't feel bad anymore, I think.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's tough. Within the book, you have, on this idea of Kim's sadness, you have a lot of empathy for Kim's sadness, but there's a lot of humour in her ruminations and the way she sort of spirals, and really in the things that she notices. Obviously, for her to notice, you have to notice... as well. How do you notice funny or curious moments in life? Do you have a way of recording them?
No, I don't. Well, sometimes I take photos, and I only realized I did this when I tried to live without my phone for a couple of weeks, and I found myself trying to do like audio recordings of the funny thing that I saw, which was a really good practice because then you've basically written it. If you put it into words instead of taking a photo. But I think I'm just one of those annoying people that when you're having a conversation with them, they're not really listening and they're looking they're like observing other things and taking note of that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to put out a call for questions shortly. So if people have questions, I'll ask this one and then you can ask yours. One of the things that I think never gets boring to hear about is how people go from having a manuscript on their computer to getting a publisher. How did that work for you?
Yeah. Well, I had submitted the opening to the Rochelle Prize for Emerging Writers in 2020, which is probably one of the only... Oh, there's actually the Vogel as well, but there's not many things you can do with an unfinished novel manuscript. You kind of have to finish it before you can show it to an agent, show it to a publisher, which is really frustrating because it takes like 3 years and sometimes you need some external motivation way, way earlier than that. So I think I had only written 3 chapters and I sent it to the Rochelle and then I ended up getting longlisted for that. And off the back of that, I got contacted by Claire, who's now my agent, who's in the States. I was so taken aback by that. I thought it was a scam, but it was a real person.
And remember getting the email? What were you doing?
I had just moved back. I'd just gotten out of hotel quarantine and I was at my mum's farm and I definitely thought it was a scam. But then I Googled them and a friend of mine is also a client of her. So I reached out to my friend and she's real. Yeah. And then I sent her what I had and I didn't hear anything for a long time. So I thought nothing, but then she eventually read it and got back to me. And then didn't finish the novel for another 2 years. And I got back to her with much trepidation because if she said no, then I knew I would have to go into the querying process, which just looks really hard. And you're kind of looking for a needle in a haystack kind of success there. If you're just like emailing agents and they're just very overrun, they don't have time. But then she read it like overnight and she was the first person to read it. And said that she loved it and it was in good shape and ready to go out. And so I did this thing where you're supposed to tell them that you want to wait 2 weeks because
what?
I don't know.
Because
I don't know. So I just said, I didn't sign with her immediately. I said I wanted a waiting period. And then I got really nervous and emailed her in the middle of the night being like, I want to sign. Because I was like, I think when I was thinking about my failures in preparation for this, I think my biggest failure is like when good things happen, I don't think they're real. And that's been happening the whole way. So then I signed with her. I went on sub in the US and Australia. And in Australia, it just happened really quickly. And I ended up, you know, all of a sudden having multiple publishers to choose from and being asked, you know, then have the... Everything just switched so quickly and I had no idea how to choose and all that stuff. But I've been so happy with the choice. So that was my path to publication. So I guess like, unfortunately, you just have to finish your manuscript. One thing, which is just the worst thing to hear ever because it's very difficult. I would recommend getting a manuscript assessment. They're expensive, but they're worth it. And I did with a friend of mine and that I went to uni with, and she saved my novel, which is so much better now because of her. So and it's a really good goal to work towards. And if you can afford it, then I would do it. Yeah.
Great advice. Questions. Does anyone in the audience have a question for Pip? Tony.
Hello. I'm wondering about the mechanics of setting a story where you're not currently living. Mm-hmm. So by the time you'd left Berlin, did you have enough memories and notes to recreate it? Did you realise that, what was that place again? Did you have to ring people and say, take photos of something? Or how did that work in a practical sense?
That's a really good question. Berlin was fine because I lived there for 5 years. So, and I was still on the phone with a friend who's sort of like my writing partner / you know, the friendship in this book is sort of inspired by our friendship. And so she was still living there. But that's tough. Like the Frankfurt Book Fair, I've never been there. And I know that lots of book people have. So I knew people would be reading it and with more experience of it than me. So I did a lot of Googling and reading weird blogs and stuff. And then the bit in New York, never been to any of those places. But I had friends in New York who would go and I sent it to them to see, like, do I sound ridiculous? And I had to change, like, them eating pancakes to them eating bagels for breakfast to be properly in New York. I would change it back, actually. I was like, because it's in a sex scene. I don't think people are eating smoked salmon before having sex. but there was stuff where I was like Google image searching the Center for Fiction in Brooklyn and trying to figure out like where the reading would be. Would they have to go upstairs? Stuff like that. But when I was doing stuff in Berlin, it was all from memory. And that was probably one of the most emotionally hard things, being in like the millionth lockdown here writing about like going clubbing and dancing. But it was also like really nice to document it somehow too.
And if you had have gotten those things wrong, would it have mattered? No one else knew but you. Would you have cared about that?
It felt pretty good to be told that I did the Frankfurt Book Fair right by like a publishing person, although I put them all as drinking coffee and they were like, no, they'd be outside drinking Red Bulls and smoking cigarettes, all the literary agents. No, I'm glad that I got it right because for me, I wanted it to like capture my time in Berlin. So it was important to me, if nobody else, yeah.
Any other questions? Okay, I have one. People often, from a writing perspective, talk about being a pantser or a plotter. Where do you sit on that continuum?
I would say that I like lightly plot. So I knew that it was going to be three parts, and the beginning of each part was an incident on a train. And then I knew the big twist, which is like the end of Act Two, but that's it. Like, I only know how to structure thing in a structure stories in a three-act structure. So I use that. I would say I'm sort of like a you're driving in the fog type person. So you can see a couple of steps in front of you, but you don't know where you're going to end up. Yeah.
It's a good analogy. For me, one of the things about your book and about sad girl novels in general is that they never make me feel sad as a reader. Is there a particular experience that you wanted your reader to have?
I definitely didn't want people to feel sad. And I don't think... I think it's really nice. The thing that I like about fiction is when it's, like, super honest and very, like, eviscerating of the self almost, where the writers... Not that I'm doing this, but... where the writers are sort of like opening themselves up and showing some pretty ugly parts of themselves as well. But I think it's so nice to hear that somebody else feels these things that we're not supposed to feel. I think they're not always sad. I would say women in these types of books are like sad, bad, or mad. Like they're things that we're not supposed to be in real life. So it's sort of refreshing and nice to watch someone be that unapologetically, yeah.
It always strikes me too that it's sad girl novels. Do you think girls are sad? Or do you think it's that we would call a sad boy novel something different?
Yeah, I was thinking about this. I think one way to think about it is a sad boy, if Kim was a boy, she'd just be a genius, I think. not her in particular, but... it's just called literature when it's a sad man. Yeah. like maybe The Virgin Suicides is a good example of a book that's like got all the markings of a sad girl novel, but it's written by a man, and I love that book, but it would never be called that. And I think most of the books that I read by men would probably fall under queer literature. So, and then when it's like NASCAR or something, it's just like, it's just a serious book. They're allowed to be sad, I think.
Pip, we like to end the podcast by asking for writing advice. You've given some already. Other writing advice, either the best writing advice you've ever received or the worst?
Well, it ties a little bit to the book because the book kind of explores the role of delusion in the creative process. And I would say create a little world where you're completely deluded and everything that you're imagining in your mind, you're going to be able to pull off on the page and don't think about anything bad. But then still be connected to reality in the rest of your life. It's important. And then also, like, just no one's ever going to spend as much time on your writing than you. So I would... just make sure that you're doing it in a way that brings you joy and worry about everyone else later.
I think that's great advice. Final question. Can you recommend a book? It can be from any year, any author, fiction, non-fiction, any genre, by a debut author.
I was thinking about this. There's a book called Sorry to Disrupt the Peace by Patrick Cottrell, who is an American author, and that's a debut maybe in 2018. and it's published by McSweeney's. And I think the voice of that book, I mean, I'm drawn to books because of the voice more than the plot. And that's the thing that I love to like play around with when I'm writing is voice. And the voice of that book is just so flat and sardonic. And it's sort of like a contemporary noir. And it's another, it's called, the author calls it an anti-memoir because he was born in Korea and then adopted to an American family, and the protagonist is the same. But the author's just like playing around with all these conventions of autofiction and memoir, and it's very cool. Yeah.
Love that one we haven't had before. Thanks, Pip, for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.